rise. The Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session.
Yeah, please be seated. Welcome to the Arizona Court of Appeals for Division 1, where today we are here for oral argument in the matter Garza Duenas versus Matrix New World Engineering, Inc. As you probably realize, the matter is being both recorded and broadcast out concurrently on YouTube. So for the record, when you come up, please state your name and also the name of your client before you speak. As to the minding of time, if you say you'd like to reserve 5 minutes or 3 minutes, we'll try to honor that. But ultimately, as is generally the case, you're kind of on your own to kind of make that work. We have conferenced this case this morning and read the briefs, so you can assume our familiarity with the record, and you don't need to repeat things in the briefs, although for emphasis or choice, you may. With that, counsel, when you'd like, if you'd please begin.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Blake Lindemann. I represent the appellant and plaintiff, Sergio Garza Duenas, Jr., and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors. This case that brings us here was based on horrific circumstances. A worker who was an assistant well driller was strangled to death by a piece of equipment, and it was a significant injury and situation. There are many grounds that support reversal from appellant's view, but the three that are most specific are, first, the Circle K decision warrants reversal. Circle K, the Arizona Supreme Court specifically said that the court is to look at the circumstances, including whether the individual injured was an invitee. And specifically in this case, under Restatement Section 343, Mr. Garza Duenas was an invitee because he was a worker providing a tangible economic benefit to the work site. We cited several cases that supported that premise as well. And this goes even back to Welker from the Arizona Court of Appeal decision in 1965, discussed 343 remains a viable course for a worker injured on a site as a basis to find duty. So we flagged that as a basis.
But it's a duty to whom?
The duty is owed by the general contractor, the owner's representative, and the owner of the property.
To
Mr. Garza Duenas as a decedent. And okay. My client succeeds
doesn't
to that.
Doesn't Welker say that duty to invitees does not include to employees of independent contractors?
I think that from what it specifically says is in reference to the duty that is owed for that defendant. So what I believe Welker specifically says on that, Your Honor, is that a duty, 343 was not raised in that case. So
you just told me a minute ago that it was.
No, Your Honor, I apologize. I'd like to clarify. The court says 343 remains viable, but it was never raised. So the opinion specifically says 343 remains viable, but it was not raised.
Okay.
And I can cite to that exact language, but in any event, I think it's. Even if we look at Welker, we could put it aside because I think this court said in Lee.
Okay, so the case you just told me we should look to, we can now put aside?
I think some of parts of it. I think if you want to go by it, I mean, the trial court relied on it, right? Okay. And I think this court has said in Lee v. M&H Enterprises that it's no longer good law as it applies to Restatement 414. Based on Lewis and the Arizona Supreme Court's decisions in those matters. But let's just look at Circle K. It said, there was sort of this dispute in Arizona as to whether Restatement 343 even applied. And this court said it wasn't really clear, and the Arizona Supreme Court decided that question. So at minimum, from our view, as Your Honors know, on a summary judgment, the facts have to be considered from the opposing party and construed in our favor. Here, those facts were not even considered as to whether Mr. Garza Duenas was an invitee under 343. There is no finding. There's no discussion. There's nothing about it.
So I think Welker was a 413 case, but you claim it said 343 is viable. And obviously, Circle K, 343 exists. So, but 343, doesn't it protect against, or is the duty is to protect invitees from unforeseen hazardous things that relate to the property, not to something that the contractor brought to the property? So that's where I'm hung up on 343, is how does 343 provide a duty to your client from these people to protect against what?
Very well, Your Honor. So 343 applies to any dangerous condition. It's not limited to something inherent in the property, such as a tripping. It says any a dangerous condition
of the property.
And but I think that, Your Honor, when you look at that, this issue was never even analyzed by the trial court. It's not as if the trial court said this isn't property. To answer your second question, it applies.
Are you suggesting we just send it back and then the trial court look at it and say, well, this wasn't part of the property, and then we get another appeal out of it?
Or it says condition on the land.
Condition on the land.
Condition
right.
on the land. I mean, I'm not following up with Judge Morris's question. I'm not clear how that works for you here or why that's really a fact issue to remand.
So following up on the issue, I think that from the perspective of this is a condition on the land, and there are several cases.
So what contractors bring becomes a condition on the land because they put it there? Is that the idea?
That is correct, and it's.
And what's your case supporting that notion? Because the cases I see is stuff that the property owner put on the land, or that was inherent in the land that created the defect, not something that a third party brings to the land and then causes injury to its own people.
And Your Honor, from the perspective of that. You know, this is a new issue that I hadn't really fully vetted. I have to be candid with you. From the perspective of what we have at the trial court, is there's no discussion of any of the factors of 343, such as you say, possessors on the land. So our position is these three defendants are possessors. Our argument is also that it's a condition on the land. In other words, the case I would look at, and I think it's Stubblefield talks about some equipment issues, I think is the case. But I don't want.
In the 343 context?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
In the 343 context? About
No, it wasn't. That was in the 414 context.
Okay.
Yes. So I wanted to be, I want to be very clear. I would like the opportunity to, and I understand where you're coming from. My perspective, though, is that it is a condition on the land because it is part of, it's a fixture that's attenuated. This drilling rig is built into the land to do the construction work. And so it's a pertinent, it's fixed in. And from my perspective, this is a new issue. Nobody has ever brought this up. This isn't even in the briefs. So from my perspective, I would just like the opportunity to do a one paragraph or one page letter, if that's an issue that the court is really looking at.
Well, I don't want to waste too much of your time on this, but if you didn't bring it up below, why wouldn't we just apply waiver and move on? Why would I give you an opportunity to bring it up now and do supplemental briefing beyond what you've already put in your briefs?
I think because we argued 343 applied, we raised 343 in a post-judgment motion after Circle K was issued. We set forth why each element applied. Nobody said, hey, it doesn't apply because this isn't a defect on the land. The trial court never ruled this isn't a defect on the land. Had the trial court made that ruling and said, hey, I've looked at these elements, I don't think it meets this element, I would agree with you. That would be waiver. But from our perspective, because we thought we met every element and we advanced every element, from our perspective.
Post-trial motion?
Correct. In our post-trial motion, we said three.
We also have a general principle in Arizona law that if you don't raise an argument in a summary judgment motion, it's waived as well. I mean, in response to a summary judgment. So I'm like, it seems like I don't want to get hung up on waiver because I think you've got other issues here that you want to talk about. But
I appreciate that. Just from my perspective on the waiver, It can't be waiver because the case was issued after the ruling.
No, 343 was in existence, and all Circle K did was kind of restate the existence of what we already knew.
Well, we didn't know because, respectfully, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals said it did not apply 343, and then the Arizona Supreme Court then applied 343 and said it applies in Arizona to a business invitee.
Okay.
Thus, we set forth in there. I think the city of Kingman, too, involved a defect of fireworks. It was not a land defect, and there was no finding. That case did come out against the plaintiff, but that case did not find that 343 was unavailable because of that issue. So I would just point those things out, and I appreciate that, Your Honor.
I don't need waiver on this personally. I'm not interested in waiver on this, but I think substantively I'm not sure what your paragraph would say because – again, 343 provides a possessor of land subject to liability for physical harm caused to his invitees by a condition on the land, which sounds like it adheres to the land, but only if he, A, knows or by the exercise of reasonable care would discover the condition, which sounds, again, like it adheres in his land, as it's written, and should realize that it involves an unreasonable risk of harm to such invitees. It sounds like you should know in the prior contemplation before someone comes there. It just doesn't sound like something under the language of 343 someone can bring in and create that condition on the land. It seems very inconsistent with the text to me.
Yeah, and I think that the way I'm listening to you say a condition on a land can mean any condition. It's not
a later arising condition? How do you previously understand in the exercise of reasonable care and discover it if your independent contractor brings it in?
Yeah.
It's confusing.
To put a kind of visual perspective on that, I mean, what you're arguing is that I can go and I can take like a stepladder to a grocery store, put it down myself in the middle of the grocery store, trip over it, and then sue the grocery store because the condition of their land is dangerous.
Well, I think you'd be inviting the own harm you cause if you brought your own ladder, but putting that aside.
Well, I mean, you have like a drill rig.
But putting that
here
aside, yeah, I know from our perspective, and I think we could find case law to support it, I haven't seen any Arizona law that says the condition of land is limited to a defect on a land, such as a tripping nature. You know, if that were the case.
Oh, but it has to be a condition that exists that's inherently dangerous.
Well, there's no doubt it's inherently dangerous. That is undisputed in the record. It existed on that site for several months, and it's been there. It was installed.
Not before the invitees were brought. Well, okay.
It was before the invitees.
You said you had three, so.
Yeah, it was. I understand. I appreciate it. And the second point is the status alone, dating back to the 70s and the Pruitt decision and the Floor decision, says that a general contractor or prime contractor, an owner's representative or the owner of the land can be liable. And we cited several cases saying that proposition. No cases have gone against that. Only Lee v. M&H, it went to trial, all the way to trial, and found that because the worker was an employee, that it was an employee of the general contractor, that a directed verdict would issue. So there, again, you know, when we look at Pruitt, we look at Floor, we look at all these cases, even Dabush talks about it. You know, the Arizona Supreme Court case said, we don't have the general contractor here. You're not a general contractor. You're not an owner's representative. You're not owner. So I think the record is very clear. We look at the contracts that based on their roles as owner, general contractor, and owner's representative, they have a duty. Whether there's retained control and they breached the duty was not reached by the trial court, that's a question of fact. And Welker makes that very clear, as does Circle K, Dabush, and all the other cases. So we think reversal is warranted on that second ground. The third ground.
Your second point then would be the retained control theory.
The third point would be retained control under 414.
414. Okay.
Correct. Right. Our second theory is based on status alone. And Pruitt specifically says this. Pruitt says.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be difficult. I just want to make sure I follow. No. The theory of liability is. What is the duty that you're saying was violated?
Yes.
On point two.
On point two, the duty is owed from the general contractor to a worker on site as a duty, as a matter of law. So the general contractor owes a worker on the site a duty, and this is what Judge Campbell discussed in the Al-Sadi decision in denying summary judgment and entered a judgment against Intel in that case, the owner, and the general contractor, JLL, property manager, excuse me.
So it's strict liability, general contractor?
There has to be a breach. What is the duty that was breached by the general contractor in this case?
No, it's not strict liability. It's just duty. The general contractor has a duty to supervise, oversee the contractor. The trial court never...
So regardless of what the contract says, the general contractor is an overall safety insurer? Is that what you're saying?
They owe a duty, yes, under the law. They're not a safety insurer per se, but they owe a duty under the law based on Arizona authority.
Duty to protect against all injuries from that might be suffered by employees of independent contractors.
Correct. That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And that is, as I said, there are several cases, but this goes back to the 60s. And the trial court's ruling does not address this at all, does not reference whether their owner's representative, whether their general contractor, or even whether it's an owner, can be liable. And so, as I said as well, Lee v. M&H is the only case that kind of goes into this a little bit, but then it's very interesting. They grant summary judgment because they say that the general contractor was a co-employer. It was a Lent employee, which is not part of this record. So for that reason, it should be reversed. The third ground we have is under 414. And I think here we have our best argument. I mean, I think all three arguments are very, very cohesive. And I appreciate your first point about condition on the land. It's making me really think I'd like to look at that. But the third issue I think that's really, really interesting is we have a technical specifications manual issued 6 months before this subcontractor's hired. The owner, general contractor, owner's representative create the manual, how this is going to be drilled, the means and methods. And they specifically write in there 6 months before the subcontractor's hired, it's to be via air rotary method, which is a safer method. And that was not complied with. All of the contracts specifically say the general contractor has a duty to enforce the technical specifications. They didn't. The wrong equipment and dangerous equipment was used. So from the retained control perspective, Lewis, all the cases make clear that if the contract discusses retaining control over the means and methods, even if not over the direct day-to-day supervision of the employee, you can have retained control questions that go to the jury. I see I'm running out of my time quickly. I do think that this is a case that's appropriate for 519 restatement section, strict liability as well. There are also other statutory arguments we've made, but in the interest of time, unless there's any questions, I would cede and reserve for the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tony Hancock on behalf of the Appalee Maricopa Mountain Domestic Water Improvement District, which I will refer to as the district going forward. And in light of our time restrictions, all three Appalee Council convened and agreed that we would keep our respective arguments under 7 minutes. As your honors consider appellant's many theories and arguments in his appeal, I believe it's most important that we focus on the mechanism of this tragic injury. Despite all the theories that appellant's counsel has injected into the case, the drilling contractor's own employee became entangled in equipment that was owned by, maintained by, selected for use by, and operated by the drilling contractor itself, Arizona Beam and Drilling, which is reputed to be one of the largest and most reputable water well drilling contractors in our state. The district did not own, maintain, select, or otherwise have any control over Beam and Drilling. And they didn't have any control over the drill rig, nor should they have, as they are not drill rig operators. And they are generally unfamiliar with the various parts and appurtenances to a drill rig.
Can you please harmonize what you're explaining to us with his assertion a couple minutes ago that it had to be done by the air rotary method that was safer?
The air rotary method is an equivalent method, not necessarily a safer method, but it could be an equivalent method to that which was ultimately utilized, and that was something that Arizona Beam and Drilling ultimately recommended and advocated for as the method that they wanted to use to do this drilling. And those that were landowners, general contractors, and subcontractors acquiesced to that as another method that could be utilized by the drill rig operator who was in charge of the drill rig itself. This accident was investigated by ADOSH immediately afterwards and cited Arizona Beeman for operating its drill rig without a cat head over a rotating aspect of the drill rig. According to Arizona Beeman's employees, this drill rig wasn't even designed to have a protective guard over the cat head. The district didn't know what a cat head was on a drill rig. And according to Arizona Beeman's folks, no one from the district would have been allowed up onto the elevated drill rig platform while the drill is in operation to have even been in a position to observe whether there was a cat head or where it would be located, or that it didn't have a protective guard on it while in operation. The agreement between the district and Arizona Beam and Drilling made it very clear that the decedent's employer was, quote, solely responsible for the means, methods, techniques, sequences, and procedures of construction, close quote, and, quote, for initiating, maintaining, and supervising all safety precautions and programs in connection with the work, close quote, and that the district was expressly not responsible for any failure of decedent's employer to comply with laws and regulations applicable to the work. Arizona case law makes it very clear that the issue of whether one party owes a duty to another is a question of law for the court. That same case law in Vinas and other cases has also made clear that a landowner, like the district, who hires an independent contractor, like Arizona Beam and Drilling, owes no duty to protect the employee of an independent contractor from that contractor's own negligence. The weighty policy considerations in play behind this well-established no liability rule are embedded in our state workers' compensation scheme and are explained in the Vinas court's decision. Appellant has already succeeded in his pursuit of a workers' compensation claim against Arizona Beam and Drilling, demonstrating that the decedent was, in fact, an employee of the drilling contractor, despite appellant's counsel's incredulous attempts to place that well-established fact into question, the obvious intent of which was to undermine the strength of this well-established no-duty, no-liability rule. Appellant's reliance on the Arizona Supreme Court of Circle K, or Perez versus Circle K convenience stores, attempting to define decedent's relationship to the district as that of a business invitee is completely misplaced. Decedent's relationship that determined the duty owed by the district to the decedent, if any, is the relationship between an owner and its independent contractor's employee. And Arizona courts have declined to apply business invitee status to employees of an independent contractor. Both in the Lee M&H Enterprises case, Rouse, Koepke, all of those cases support that proposition.
Don't you think if Circle K involved, let's say, a supplier, Circle K contracts with Anheuser-Busch to come and stock their refrigerators with beer, obviously, because that's what Anheuser-Busch does, and the employee is carrying cases of beer in, and Circle K has spilled a big puddle of oil in the middle of the floor, and the employee falls, they would still have premises liability would attach, even though it was a employee of a contractor with Circle K who supplies them beer. I don't understand how you would say otherwise.
I wouldn't. I think that's a condition on the premises that arguably, depending upon the protocols in place at Circle K, whether they were monitoring for spills, whether they retained control.
Well, but the breach would be a different issue. We're talking about duty here. So you would acknowledge there would be a duty in that situation to protect, even though it's an employee of an independent contractor.
whether it's an independent contractor is a question in my mind. I think you've got a supplier who is bringing product onto the property. But I think the condition that exists, depending upon the mode of operations within the store, as to whether they were monitoring, were aware, or should have been aware of the spill, is a condition that would put them, would obligate them to a duty.
Okay. So isn't the issue here then not whether there was a duty, and maybe you're not, I'm not asking you to concede it, but under my hypothetical, it's not whether there was a duty, it's whether there's been a breach of that duty.
No, I think the question here is whether there is a duty. I mean, the cases have, in fact, established that there is no duty except for the exceptions.
Let's change my hypothetical. If at the site of the drilling rig there was a hole that you guys had covered up with cardboard.
Completely different situation than what we're dealing with here.
But you would still owe a duty to the employee of the independent contractor to at least advise them, do something to protect them against that hole.
You've got a condition on the property that would create a duty.
So there is a duty. Again, the question is, has there been a breach of that duty? You would argue there hasn't been because there was nothing inherent in the property. There was no condition on the property that caused the damage. It's what they brought to the property.
Exactly.
So in my hypothetical, you'd say, yes, if we had dug a hole and covered it with cardboard, we might owe a duty that had been breached. But here, there was no hole till they dug it.
Exactly. If the Anheuser-Busch stocker had dropped a beer and spilled it himself, I think that's a different condition.
Okay.
But if this is a condition outside of the control, I think that there could be a duty under the retained control mode of operation considerations of the store owner.
Okay. Thank you.
The Arizona courts have established a well-defined body of law regarding the duty owed by a landowner of the employee of its independent contractor after examining all the potential exceptions to the general rule of non-liability. Since Perez only address the duty owed by a convenience store to its customer, it provides no guidance to this action and is not applicable at all. Appellant asserts that the Arizona courts have extended invitee protections to workers in similar circumstances, citing Fort Lowell, Pruitt, and the Robertson cases, but none of those cases involved workers in similar situations as the decedent in this case. Regarding the restatement of 414, retained control, appellant also advocates that an exception to the general rule of no duty is the restatement 414, where the landowner can be held liable based on the theory of retained control, and the lower court devoted a considerable amount of attention in its ruling addressing this theory before properly granting summary judgment. The court's devotion to this theory was for good reason, in that section 414 is the only restatement section that could potentially apply to support claims by an independent contractor's employee against a landowner. In order to trigger liability under 414, appellant has to show that the district didn't just own the premises, which in this case was just a vacant, raw piece of land, but that it retained control over the actual work being performed. The Arizona courts have established that both the governing contractual provision and the actual exercise of control over the work are relevant considerations when considering retained control. As previously discussed, the contractual provisions couldn't be more clear. And as for retained control, the district was not on the drill site at the time of this tragic incident. It did not.
Counsel, I thought you had said you were going to limit yourself to 7 minutes. We're into a minute 11 now.
Minute 11. I'm sorry. That was.
You've got a clock right in front of you. I'm just thinking about your co-counsel.
Sorry. I'll speed it up. Thank you.
I mean, you're just reading, so I would.
Arizona Beam and Drilling was entirely free to operate and conduct the work that it was operating its drill rig. The only other comment I'll make is that plaintiff or appellant has alleged probably 8 or 9 additional theories, remote theories against the well-established rule of no actionable duty, none of which apply when the injured party was the contractor's employee. And so we would request, Your Honors, that the court grant or deny, affirm the lower court's decision depriving the plaintiff of his claims in their entirety. And with that, Your Honor, we would respectfully request the summary judgment decision be affirmed and request that the court deny appellant's unfounded request for attorney's fees and costs, but allow the district to recover its costs on appeal. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll give you 5 extra minutes if you keep the 7 total, so they get 7.
I will try to make up, Your Honors. May it please the court.
Give you additional time.
So if you end at 1 minute, we'll add 5 minutes.
May it please the court, Andy Everode for Defendant Appellee Westland Resources, Inc. I'd like to just touch on the couple things that counsel raised in their argument. First and second, Westland Resources was not the property owner. That's not disputed. But we've heard counsel for a long time throw out phrases like owner's rep or general contractor, presumably to somehow tie Westland Resources into an owner equivalent obligation. With respect to owner's rep, there's no factual explanation for why Westland was an owner's rep for anything beyond the scope of what Westland Resources provided in this case. There's no evidence that, Westland's role somehow translated into an ownership obligation that gave rise to some duty to anybody on the property. And I'll get into the contract language in a second. With respect to the general contractor term, the cases that are cited all have to do with what we'd all expect a general contractor would be, a construction company that hires subs to do different portions of the work. That's not the case here. The most appellant can point to is Paul Tremels, the COO of Westland's testimony, where he acknowledged that Westland was a prime contractor. But that's...
Who hired Beeman?
The district.
Okay. Who negotiated or acted as the party that told them to hire Beeman?
Okay, good question, Your Honor. So this was a USDA project, Department of Agriculture. The record reflects, and Westland testified about this, that USDA provides qualifications to Westland. Westland looked at the applications and they said Beeman is the lowest qualified bidder based on USDA's qualifications.
So in some way, at least, and I realize this is probably a factual dispute between you guys recommended Beeman based upon your evaluation. You would say it was just objective metrics, but you guys were still the ones that evaluated the people who applied and then said Beeman's the one who meets the qualifications.
And the way you stated that, Your Honor, at the end is exactly right. Based on the objective standards, we said Beeman is the lowest qualified bidder.
How is that different when you're making the decision? I think there's RFPs all the time where employers are, where company says, we need someone who can do A, B, C, and D.
Yes.
They hire someone to kind of do those things, and the person, the group, whether it's the general contractor or whatever title you want to give it, says, well, the people who can do D, according to your RFP, is this company. They're the only ones who meet the qualifications.
True.
Is that any different than what you guys have done?
It's no different, Your Honor, but there's no evidence in this case that Beeman was unqualified. The fact that this accident took place doesn't mean that they weren't qualified.
My point, though, is I have trouble seeing what's different between you and your role and what we see commonly as a general contractor.
Fair enough, but keep in mind that typically with a general contractor, the general contractor is overseeing explicitly the means and methods by which the subs do the work. That was explicitly disclaimed here, and I'm not going to waste the time to read it. It's in the papers, all the contract language in the district Westland contract and in the district Beeman contract. Again, we had no contract with Beeman. I just want to touch, too, with respect to general contractor, going back to Paul Tremel's testimony, he said that the prime contractor reference had to do with the relationship of the parties in the contracts. Westland held the prime contract with the district and then subconsulted with Matrix. That doesn't translate into any kind of general contractor hat that then somehow rises to giving a duty to Mr. Garza-Duenas on the property.
But Section 411, which creates the potential for a negligent selection duty, that simply is about the fact of selection. It doesn't presuppose a continuing general contractor supervision role in its text, does it?
Very true, Your Honor. And again, there's no evidence that it was negligent to select or say that Beeman was the lowest qualified bidder.
Well, I appreciate that position. Yeah. I'm just clarifying that it doesn't require an ongoing general contractor relationship.
Your Honors, just given the time, unless you have any additional questions, I'd just say there's no duty from Westland to Beeman. The contract language explicitly disclaims that. This is a tragic accident that had nothing to do with Westland. I will just point out, Westland had 5 visits to the site 3 months before the accident. 4 of those had to do with surveying. 1 had to do with a pre-construction meeting in the district's on-site office. None of them at a well site. There's no evidence that the drill had even been mobilized by that point. 3 months later, accident occurs. We had no actual ownership. We had no actual control. We had no retained control. Westland asks that this court affirm the decision of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. And just, counsel, I've been third. I got 100 seconds one time. Let's stop the clock for a second, please. So you can have up to 7 minutes, so you don't get stuck in that position, which is generally what would happen in this court. But when you go over the zero, anytime you take – no, let's keep it at 257 for a moment, please. Thanks. And then you can go all the way over, which would be negative 4 minutes essentially, but it's going to add it back to him, just so you know.
Yes.
So it's your choice.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks a lot. Please restart. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good morning. Elizabeth Garcia and Mariah Logan for Defendant, Appellee, and Cross Appellant, Matrix New World Engineering, Inc. I'd like to briefly start with Judge Morse's question, which I thought was pertinent. Why is this an issue of duty? If general contractors, land possessors or owners, and subcontractors owe duties under the law, why is this dismissal appropriate as a matter of no duty in, as opposed to no breach? Well, for 2 reasons. The first is based on how plaintiff chose to frame the duty analysis below. It was plaintiff's obligation as the person bringing the claims to establish a cognizable duty. Instead of relying on the well-established Arizona authority defining duties belonging to landowners, general contractors, and subcontractors, plaintiff chose to throw the mud at the wall and rely on numerous novel theories that are unsupported by the restatement provisions they rely on, unsupported by the statutes, unsupported by the contracts. Again, the briefing is extensive on this issue. And so the duties that plaintiff claims existed and on which he chose to base his claims, they don't exist as a matter of law. They are not cognizable under Arizona authority. So that's why it's the no duty. That's the first reason why the no duty ruling was correct. The second reason is because under Perez, the Arizona Supreme Court's decision, for a duty of care to exist, the injuries have to arise within the scope of the legally recognized special relationship. With regards to Matrix, Matrix was a subconsulting hydrogeologist on this project. For plaintiff to assert a duty of care arising from Matrix's role as a subcontractor, subconsultant on this project, he had to produce evidence that he incurred an injury that arose within the scope of Matrix's work as a subconsulting hydrogeologist, and he didn't. As the district explained in their oral argument today, the mechanism of the injury is not in dispute. This was a tragic accident that resulted from the decedent's use of equipment he was operating in the course and scope of his employment by Beeman, and that equipment was provided by Beeman. That specific drill rig was selected by Beeman, and it was used by Beeman. Matrix's geologists and principal geologists did not know how to operate that equipment. They didn't operate it. They didn't control it. Much like the district's employees, they weren't even allowed to step onto the platform of this drill rig to obtain geologic samples while it was in operation. There's simply no evidence that the decedent incurred any injury.
I think we need the clock to run forward now.
Yeah, let's put 4 on there, please.
Okay.
Thanks. Sorry, counsel.
No problem.
Thanks.
There's simply no evidence that the decedent incurred any injury due to Matrix's performance of its obligations as a subconsulting hydrogeologist. And I do want to note, the trial court didn't have to reach this issue, but at summary judgment, Matrix did argue that there was no duty for the grounds that the duty theories that plaintiff asserted. But it also asserted, and I refer the court to IR 169 at pages 14 to 15 and IR 225 at pages 16 to 18, it also argued that plaintiff had not produced any evidence that Matrix had breached the only duty that Arizona law recognizes it owed, that duty to perform its own work with reasonable care under Sarmiento. And plaintiff, and so that issue, there's no need to remand for rebriefing of that issue. That issue was briefed below. The trial court didn't need to reach it because plaintiff based his claims on non-cognizable duties and didn't establish any injury that arose within the scope of Matrix's performance of his subconsulting obligations. But this court could affirm, independently affirm, the trial court's grant of summary judgment to Matrix on the ground of no breach as well as no duty. And unless this court has any further questions, I'd like to briefly touch on the issue of sanctions. The court did not set oral argument on the cross appeal, so this is specifically referring to the sanctions request for this appeal. Plaintiff has known since before he filed his second amended complaint in this action that Matrix was not an employer, that Matrix wasn't a general contractor, didn't own the land, didn't owe the numerous duties that he claims it did.
So, counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
Our Supreme Court recently decided in Arizona Republican Party versus Richer a pretty stringent standard for imposing those types of sanctions. Can you specifically address that?
Yes, Your Honor. So what Richer does is it clarifies the different tests and the showings of lack of good faith and the presence of bad faith in terms of the enumerated conduct detailed in ARIS 12349A.
Didn't Richer say that even if it's not necessarily supported by existing law, if it's a good faith ask to expand existing law, that isn't sanctionable? And isn't that what he's asking us to do here? It's like, well, there's some wiggle room here and some wiggle room there. We're asking you to say these causes of action apply in these circumstances.
And specifically, if they're long shots, they don't get sanctioned.
That is fair. Riker does say good faith requests to change law. But this is not a good faith request to change law.
Why?
He has known, for example, focusing on the employer-employee theory of liability, before the Second Amended complaint was filed, plaintiff knew exactly who employed Garza Duenas. In fact, Garza Duenas' employer, Beeman, was dismissed from this action early on under the workers' comp exclusive remedy. He had deposed Beeman. He had deposed Matrix. Yet he continues to insist, well, you owed you're the putative employer. There is no law, no case, no basis for any request to expand Arizona authority to impose a employer-employee theory of liability on a subconsulting hydrogeologist who has no contract with Beeman, no contract with Garza Duenas, no control or engagement with how Beeman performs its drilling activities.
Who would be liable for the sanctions in this case if we had reversed and imposed sanctions?
Great question on it. Under ARS 12349, the sanctions requested would be recoverable against plaintiff's counsel. Plaintiff is a minor, and under Rule 17G, sanctions are not recoverable against him or his guardian. But ARS 12349 is very clear. An attorney or party who breaches any one of the enumerated grounds is liable for sanctions.
As for sanctions on appeal,
yes, Your Honor.
17G prohibit us from awarding sanctions against, I'm sorry. I don't need to answer that question. It's okay.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, counsel. We're at time. Let's put this back before counsel starts to around 7, up to exactly 7 minutes. Let's wait while we run this down to make it precise, please.
Wait for
that. You're okay, doing it the right way.
So your friends here have given you some extra time, so 7 minutes, counsel.
Very well. Thank you, Your Honors. So I want to touch base with what I first heard, that we can't rely on multiple restatement sections to support duty. Arizona Supreme Court has said the opposite. We can rely on independent grounds to support duties, and it's permissible under every single case ever issued by the Arizona Supreme Court. She also mentions, and her co-counsel from Westland mentioned, that the record doesn't support that they're owners, representatives, or general contractors. And they go so far as to saying, because of that, that supports sanctions. Your Honors, I hope that you consider the record, and I want to look to a few provisions, just so we're very, very clear. Westland's contract states, it is the owners represented on the project, and as such will interpret and enforce the plans and specifications. Those are the very plans with the air rotary method that were violated. That's it, the second page of our appendix. And it also says Westland is to consult and act as owner's representative. That's on page 42 of our appendix.
Okay, so you're talking about Westland. I believe council is talking about Matrix.
I'm going to get to that, yeah. So I just wanted to be very clear because the record is very clear on this. Westland subconsultant contract with Matrix refers to as the prime agreement with the district, which, as I pointed out in the briefing, ARS defines what a prime contractor is as including general supervisory requirements. Matrix contract, App 25, specifically says prime agreement flow down provisions. This is a term of art in contractual lingo. It specifically says Matrix will comply with the terms and conditions of Westland's prime agreement as a flow down contractual obligation. Couldn't be any more crystal clear. Then it says, this gets even better.
So you're saying that this particular contract term means that Matrix at any time could have said, whoa, Beeman, what are you doing here with that? Get that stuff out of here. This is supposed to be air rotary.
That's correct. When a party, and this is true under the restatement, under the laws of any state, when somebody steps in the shoes as a general contractor or a prime contractor, they have a supervisory obligation as a matter of law. That is correct. Of everybody on the site.
Okay. So your that rather stunning statement, which contradicts what counsel has argued, is based entirely on that one sentence out of that contract.
No, it's not. I was going to get to the next sentence. I have more. It says, four Matrix employee were designated as the owner's representative, and the contract required Westland and Matrix shall designate specific individuals to act as Matrix owner's representatives. So it also says that four employees of Matrix are designated as site representatives, project representatives. So it's not just, yeah, there's a lot here, Your Honors. And so those are the main two points. And that is at page, just to be clear, that reference is at page 47 and page 3 of our appendix. So all these are found in the very first pages of our appendix. We put that there front and center so you could see it. In any event, to argue that they're not general contractors or that they're only a general contractor in one facet defies basic contract law in this state and any state, frankly. It's just not the law. When you're a general contractor, you have those responsibilities as a matter of law. And there's no Arizona case, by the way, that's negated that on duty specifically. They also bring up there was nothing in the record about the negligent selection claim. We brought a standalone negligent selection claim. We raised 411 of the restatement. There are specific things in the record about how this company was using old and obsolete equipment. And there are several.
On your negligent selection claim, the one case you cite from Minnesota, I think it's called Alonzo, did not deal with an employee of the independent contractor. So I think Arizona recognizes a negligent selection or would recognize a negligent selection of an independent contractor, but would it apply in this case? This is the clear majority, and I couldn't find a case that went the other way, says that's not a duty to employees of the independent contractors.
I think you're right. It was a third party in that Minnesota case, but we did cite other cases where it was a employee of a subcontractor.
You did? Okay.
Yes.
I'll recheck the briefing.
From our perspective, I think the duty on its face would apply because it goes back to some of the same language of 411. It can apply against any possessor of land. So I think from our perspective, the language as to who the duty runs against is similar to 414, which, as you, Your Honor, has pointed out, applies. I did want to push back real quickly with 1 minute 30 left on my clock. 343 says on the land, not of the land. So I went back and looked at the actual language. Mm-hmm. If it had said of the land, a condition of the land, I would say it's a better argument to say, well, it applies to a stair. If I trip on a stair, that would be considered of the land. It says any condition on the land. So
you're throwing my hypothetical back to you. If you went out there and your employees dug a deep hole and then covered it with cardboard, and then one of your employees fell in that hole, you would say that the owner of the land is liable.
They're one of the parties jointly liable, yes. Yeah, a duty is owed, and the question becomes, maybe
there
they
was
could...
There no hole when they hired you, but after they hired you, you dig a hole and didn't cover it properly, and that's the landowner's responsibility.
They would be jointly liable, would be our position. And I think going back to that, I think any condition that persists on the land, it goes then to the breach question, which Your Honor said, which is never ruled on. I think then the question becomes, did they exercise control? They've been conflating in their argument breach of duty with duty, and whether they exercise actual control, as the Supreme Court said in Lewis, is not the touch mark on whether there's a duty. Whether there's a duty looks at, as the court said in Dabush and said most recently Circle K, we look at what are the relationships of the parties. And so I think from the perspective where the contract specifically, sorry, I see my time's out, but where the contract specifically says that they are going to discuss means and methods, that's sufficient even without taking control of the employee. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you all, Counsel, for your excellent arguments. They're very helpful. You've given us things to think about. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue a decision in due course. We're adjourned.